As you describe in the book, there are a lot of your colleagues who were from the British Isles, Irish and Scotch, and folks who came over to give it a go as well, who thought of themselves as, well, I might as well go to Florida and stay for a couple of months of vacation on somebody else's dime.
Absolutely true, absolutely true. They come with no intention of staying. But, you know, a month in Florida traveling, you know, at the Enquirer's expense. And they had pretty lavish expenses. We didn't get to make any money off them, but we could stay wherever we wanted and eat and drink whatever we wanted. And if we wanted to, you know, hire a helicopter, then we damn well did. They didn't care what we spent because the paper was making a ton of money.
Was there shame in making that transition from the paper's mainstream, and again in quotation marks, to tabloid?
I did some major stories for the Enquirer. I mean, I really did. I didn't do too many celeb stories, especially in the early days. I was doing things like, you know, the CIA and their remote viewing. I worked for 3 months with an astronaut, with Edgar Mitchell, you know, the sixth man to walk on the moon, the guy who drove the lunar lander. We went around the country together. He was introducing me to some of his contacts. I did all kinds of big stories for the paper that were valid. There's no question about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of those stories I've covered myself. I know Edgar Mitchell and I've interviewed him and Hal Puthoff and those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Puthoff and Targ, where I was very close to them. I did a whole series. In fact, I actually broke their major stories in the popular press. These are guys who were working for the CIA on a nine-year contract, a $1.1 million a year contract that actually got extended. The DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, took over. And that line of investigation to train psychic spies lasted for 20 years and $25 million. The DOD is probably still doing it. But of course, it mysteriously just stopped and all went away in 1995 officially.
Well, we'll get into some of the big stories and details about them. I think I want to talk about more about the mechanism of how it works at these tabloids, because the question I was asking, whether there was any trepidation or shame involved in making the switch. I know you got to work on some big stories, but you also know that it's a much different environment going there to work for a tabloid.
And the beast today is a different one. You know, the tabloids today are celebrity fan rags. You know, they're really not very good. But to come back to your point, a guy who worked there, Ray Smith, a friend of mine, is Canadian. And one of his Canadian pals was going home to Toronto for the weekend or something. And Ray said, if you see my mom, he says, don't tell her I'm on the National Enquirer. She thinks I'm playing piano in a whorehouse. so it might give you an idea. You know, it was not something that, although in the mid 70s, before the tabloids started to go celebrity, I mean, I was welcomed into, you know, as I say, DARPA. I was welcomed right into their headquarters. I've been into the Langley. I've been into the CIA building for the Enquirer. It wasn't shameful at first. And then when they started going after the celebrities and the celebrities fought back, there's a whole history behind that. The celebrities wanted their secrecy. They wanted their – you talk about secrecy, you know, secrets in government and UFO research. Well, celebs are the same. When the studio system collapsed and celebs are no longer making 5 or 6 movies a year, you know, a small cadre of them, when a celeb got a chance at one $10 million movie, and that would probably be his career, they suddenly decided they couldn't have these cozy relationships with the press anymore, where they were being, you know, they were hand in hand. That was really the way of it. And the publisher of the Enquirer decided that nice isn't news. And he wanted celebrity stories that showed them for what they were. And then the celebs brought in their own watchdogs and shut down, you know, they closed the gates. So the tabs were left with no real choice but to
dig through their garbage cans.
Yeah, indeed, they did just that. Because the thing is that if they're not going to cooperate, you've got to get the story somehow if you want to sell magazines. And that was the bottom line. I mean, that's the bottom line whether it's the New York Times or the Financial Times or the Globe. They just want to sell a magazine.
Talk to me for a couple of minutes on how it worked, because that's what people want to know, I think, is do you just make this stuff up out of thin air? Do you sit around and brainstorm and let's make a story about the incredible wrestling cheese and have a good laugh about it? Or how does it work?
The wrestling cheese, actually, he used to lose all his bouts, you know, because that was the problem. They did it by rhymes. No, nowadays, the tabs basically decide on a headline, and then they go and backfill from there. They'll say, well, let's, for instance, I had a briefing from Globe, and they said, we want you to go out to Honolulu and find out Obama's mother's secret sex diary. Okay, I can just see that, you know, Obama's really going to want to tell me about this one. So anyway, I went out to Honolulu and I spent a couple of weeks there digging around, and I didn't find a diary. But I did find that I was 10 months too late. His cleanup team had been in, and their friends had been shushed and their enemies had been silenced somehow.
Well, let's stay on this for a second. You think Obama had a cleanup team that basically told everybody, don't tell the story about smoking weed or chasing around that beach babe or whatever?
He told that story himself. That was innocent enough when he was a teenager. But whatever he did was shut down. I mean, it's standard operating practice. If you're running for president, that's what you do. Somebody goes in and cleans up before people pull embarrassing skeletons out of the cupboard.
Basically, though, your editors start with a headline. They send you out to find a way to justify that headline, and you basically cannot diverge from the assignment. That's how you describe it in the book.
That's pretty close to the truth. Especially under the old publisher, he approved an idea, and that's what you got. You might come up with a better story, you know.
But you don't write the actual story.
We wrote a file. It would be a 2,000-word file. I wouldn't say that this fellow is a doctor, and, you know, because I've been sitting in his surgery, I have to say where he did his internship, what training he had, what kind of a doctor he was, and have it so backed up so the attorneys would take a look at that file. Somebody would run a précis off. They'd give it to a rewrite guy. He'd write it down to 250 words, and then the attorneys would go through it and make sure. And they actually had a research department in those days that would literally check off with a dot over every word what the final write said, and make sure any quotes were absolutely right there on tape. So, of course, we found ways around it.
Well, I found that absolutely astounding and amazing and amusing, is that you had people checking the facts, but then you would find a way to manufacture facts or quotes or find someone who would say what you needed said.
The freelancers would do that, of course.
Okay,
not the
right
staff guys. The freelancers wanted to make the money, and there was good money there.